From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Just in time for July 4th, a new biography of Benjamin Franklin makes the case that he was the most accomplished American of his age, but it also tells the story of Franklin's private life, which wasn't quite as tidy as his maxims. For example, he had an illegitimate son and an illegitimate grandson. On today's Fresh Air, we talked to Walter Isaacson about his new book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. Also, we talk with journalist Ted Conover about his visit to the prisons in Guantanamo Bay, where hundreds of suspected terrorists have been held since the September 11th attacks. Conover wrote about Guantanamo for the New York Times Magazine and is also the author of a book based on his year as a prison guard at Sing Sing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has designated six terrorism suspects as eligible to be tried before military tribunals. Pentagon officials say the six, all in U.S. custody, are suspected to be al-Qaeda members or otherwise involved in terrorism. The Pentagon officials, speaking on condition of anonymity, refused to identify the six or give many details about them, including where they're being held. They said some of the six may have been trained at terrorist camps or may have been involved in fundraising and recruiting for terrorist groups. It will now be up to Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz to decide whether the individuals should actually be tried by military courts. At least 10 more American soldiers were wounded today in attacks by Iraqis. NPR's Kate Seeley reports that Iraqis are becoming increasingly frustrated at their situation and blaming Americans for the continuing power shortages, poor security, and lack of jobs.
There is a terrible power shortage here in Baghdad. Most Iraqis are getting somewhere on average of about 4 hours of electricity a day. That's partially due to sabotage of certain power lines in the country. But regardless, Iraqis are not getting much electricity, and that's tough at a time when temperatures are soaring, sometimes to as high as 120 degrees. So Iraqis are angry. They wonder why the Americans, who in their eyes are so omnipotent, why the Americans can't seem to get the electricity grid to work again. They wonder why the Americans can't seem to create jobs for them. They wonder why Americans can't bring security back to their streets.
NPR's Kate Seeley reporting from Baghdad. The unemployment rate rose to 6.4% in June, a 9-year high. The Labor Department reports most of the losses came in manufacturing jobs. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Economists had been expecting the unemployment rate to stabilize with perhaps a slight gain in payroll jobs. Instead, the job market eroded further. Businesses cut 30,000 jobs from their payrolls, which helped push unemployment up 0.3 percentage point, the highest it's been since April 1994. Once again, manufacturing was especially hard hit, losing some 56,000 jobs. The government also said more jobs were lost in May than previously estimated. In recent weeks, there have been tentative signs that the economy may finally be strengthening, but the report suggests that the rebound may take longer to arrive than economists had expected. The report also said the average work week remains stable, with no increase in overtime, more evidence that the demand for labor remains weak. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 72 points to close at 9,070. For the week, the Dow was up 81 points. This is NPR News. Officials in Iraq are offering $25 million for information leading to the capture of Saddam Hussein or confirmation of his death. The reward includes $15 million for information on either of Saddam's two sons. U.S. officials say it's important to establish the fate of Saddam and his sons so that their names can't be used to rally opposition to U.S. forces. Saddam was reportedly last seen in northeastern Baghdad in April as U.S. troops were entering the city. The U.S. is already offering a reward of $25 million for information leading to the capture of Osama bin Laden, who disappeared during the fighting in Afghanistan. A wildfire near Tucson, Arizona, is threatening homes again after authorities thought they had the 44,000-acre blaze under control. Julia Barton reports.
The Aspen fire had been nearly three-quarters contained, but but firefighters lost ground Wednesday as high winds gave the blaze new life. The U.S. Forest Service brought back teams of experts that had been pulled off the fire. The blaze once again threatens a ridge of communication towers and a University of Arizona observatory saved from the flames last month. About 60 summer homes are also now threatened. Although winds have slowed down, firefighters say it's hard to fight the flames now that they've gotten into rugged and steep canyons. The flare-up also calls into question the date residents will be allowed back into the area. Until the fire subsides, crews can't work to repair downed power lines and other dangers to the cleanup. For NPR News, I'm Julia Barton in Tucson.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 15 points, nearly 1%, to close at 1,633. For the week, the NASDAQ gained 38 points. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop features the Geographic Century, a CD from NPR's Radio Expeditions on great moments of exploration in the 20th century at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As much as Americans honor our founding fathers, particularly around July 4th, they're not often portrayed in ways that capture the drama of their lives or the ways in which they shaped our country. My guest Walter Isaacson has written a new biography of Benjamin Franklin that explains why Franklin may be the most accomplished American of his age and the most influential in inventing the type of society America would become. Franklin was the only person to sign all four of America's founding papers, the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty with France, the Peace Accord with Britain, and the Constitution. Walter Isaacson is former managing editor of Time magazine and former chair of CNN. He left CNN to become the president of the public policy think tank, the Aspen Institute. Your previous book was a biography of Henry Kissinger. Why go from a contemporary figure to one of the founding fathers?
I got very interested in Henry Kissinger's view of realism in American foreign policy and was looking back for the historical roots. And you have to go back to Ben Franklin, who played this absolutely brilliant balance of power game between France, Netherlands, and Spain during the Revolution. And people hadn't really written about that, and that was the first thing that got me interested in Franklin. And to be honest with you, Terry, after writing about a live character like Henry Kissinger, I really wanted to do somebody who'd been dead for 200 years after that.
Why?
Well, there's sort of the agony of taking on somebody, writing a critical biography of somebody who's still alive and having to deal with them afterwards. It was sort of a relief to go back and not have the person calling me up afterwards.
Oh, did Kissinger threaten to sue you or anything?
Oh, I think there were a lot of phone calls and letters.
Right, okay. Well, I should warn you, if you come to Philadelphia, there's somebody dressed like Ben Franklin who walks around the colonial part of the city a lot. So you better be careful.
Yeah, Ralph Archbold. I've run into Ralph Archbold. He's a great Franklin impersonator.
All right. Is there a certain textbook image of Ben Franklin that you'd like to rescue him from?
You got to rescue him from that doddering old sage flying the kite in the rain and spouting maxims like a penny saved is a penny earned or early to bed, early to rise. First of all, he never was an early to bed or early to rise type of guy, and he portrayed himself in that fashion, sort of as a exemplar to young tradesmen. But he was a much more complicated, nuanced man, and not exactly the person he portrayed himself to be in the autobiography.
Why don't we give an example of that? And this is starting with his part of his personal story. And this is the fact that you didn't learn this part in school. He had a child out of wedlock before he was married with a woman who was probably, what, a prostitute?
A woman of low repute is the way it's described in some of the letters. He took responsibility for the son, William, and he raised the son, educated him, and very much in love with the son. And they had a very intense and complicated relationship, William Franklin and his father, Benjamin Franklin. And William Franklin eventually became very aristocratic and stuck as a loyalist during the Revolution as the royal governor of New Jersey. And so they had this huge political falling out in 1775, just as the Revolution was beginning.
Well, he raised this son, William, with the woman that he married, Deborah. Let's talk about his marriage just a little bit. You know, you write that to be a well-respected man in the colonies, you had to be married, and that Franklin knew he had a large sexual appetite, which he had to control also. So he wanted a wife, but he wanted a wife that would bring him a dowry big enough to pay off his debt on his printing press. Why couldn't he achieve that goal?
Well, he almost married somebody who was going to bring him the dowry, but it didn't work out. And printers were not an exalted profession back then. And Franklin realized he was being a little bit too greedy to seek a dowry, and instead he decided he wanted a practical, frugal, industrious partner as his wife. And that's what Deborah turned out to be. And as he later said, in what passes for a deep romantic affection on his part, that meant all the world to me more than any other dowry, somebody who would just be my partner and would be industrious and work side by side with me in the shop.
Now, they had a common law marriage because they couldn't really get married. Would you explain why?
Well, Deborah had been married before. What happened was she and Ben Franklin got to know each other when they were both very young, when Franklin was a 16-year-old, 17-year-old runaway arriving in Philadelphia. But then Franklin goes off and lives in England, and Deborah marries somebody else, a potter. And then the potter disappears. He just runs away. And they were worried about the bigamy laws because they didn't know whether this first husband would ever reappear. So they just entered into a common law union to avoid the bigamy laws.
Mm-hmm. Which would have been punishable by 39 lashes and life imprisonment.
Oh, yes. And also he would have had to assume all the debts of the first husband, which I think worried him more than the 39 lashes.
Let's talk a little bit more about Ben Franklin's family. As we mentioned earlier, his son was illegitimate, born out of marriage, but he and his wife raised the son. And no one seems to know who the mother was. You say, well, it's one of history's delicious mysteries. So they were close when William, the son, was growing up, but then they were on the opposite sides of the Revolution. Franklin supported it, and his son remained a royalist. Can you explain that difference?
You know, it was a great human tragedy, one that reflected the tragedy of the politics of the time. Benjamin Franklin loved his illegitimate son, William, raised the kid, educated him, and then William becomes more and more aristocratic, a little bit more pretentious, starts getting a little bit too much on a high horse and putting on airs. And that's why Franklin writes the autobiography. It's a letter to his son, at least initially. It says, remember where you're coming from. You know, we were poor. We're a poor family. We're struggling tradespeople. Don't go putting on airs. But it doesn't work. William Franklin remains loyal to the crown, the royal governor of New Jersey, and in 1775, there's a great showdown between Benjamin Franklin and William Franklin over the Revolution, and they split, and Benjamin Franklin becomes an American patriot and rebel, and William Franklin remains a loyalist to the crown and is finally arrested by George Washington's troops on Benjamin Franklin's orders and finally exiled to England. What makes the soap opera even more wrenching is that William Franklin had his own illegitimate son, a kid named Temple. And Temple was a beautiful little child whom Benjamin Franklin helped raise. Benjamin Franklin provided for the education and helped raise his grandson, Temple. And when they all get together in America in 1775 and 1776, there's a struggle for the heart and the soul of this beautiful kid, Temple Franklin, between Benjamin Franklin, who wants Temple to remain, become an American patriot, and William Franklin, the kid's father, who's trying to keep him loyal to the crown. And Temple Franklin ends up siding with his grandfather and becoming a rebel. And Benjamin Franklin and his grandson Temple sail off to France together without even telling William Franklin that they were going off to France. And it was just this heart-wrenching struggle that's very personal, but it mirrors the great political struggle of the time.
Did Ben Franklin and his son William ever reconcile emotionally or politically?
Right at the end of the Revolution, after Benjamin Franklin negotiates the peace treaty that settles the Revolution and restores peace with England, William Franklin, who's then living in exile in England, writes Benjamin Franklin and says, let's reconcile. And it's a tortured, anguished letter in response from Benjamin Franklin. saying that he would love to get together, that nothing has hurt him more. But then it goes into a screed against William for having opposed him during the revolution. And it puts off for a while any reconciliation. But finally they meet in Southampton in England while Franklin is about to sail back from Europe to America, the end of the revolution. And they meet only for one evening, and it's Benjamin Franklin, William Franklin, and the grandson Temple Franklin, all at the Star Inn in Southampton, England. And all they do is negotiate over property, and they both basically take all the American properties and lands from William Franklin and transfer them to the grandson Temple, and then they never speak again and never write again.
So the answer would be, I guess, they never reconciled.
No, it was sad. It was sad.
The reason why I'm particularly interested in hearing all of this is that the Founding Fathers are always held up to us as these, like, paragons of virtue. You know, there's so much of an emphasis in some circles on family values and what that means. And, you know, and so here you have, like, one of the Founding Fathers who has a son out of wedlock. His son, Franklin's son, also has a child out of wedlock. Franklin has to have a common law marriage because his wife's first husband ran off with a slave. I mean, So, you know, when you look at, like, what the country is built on and everything, it's not,
you know, there were
it's
a
not
lot
these perfect
of
family values.
Well, there were a lot of illegitimate children back amongst the Founding Fathers in that generation. But, you know, Franklin had a very solid moral life, and I do think there are underlying values that we sometimes trivialize as family values, but the values of loyalty and honesty and industriousness, he believed in that throughout his life, and he took responsibility for everything he did. And in some ways, those are bourgeois, Market Street, middle-class values, but I think in Franklin, you actually see why they're so important to our country.
My guest is Walter Isaacson, author of the new book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Isaacson. We're discussing his new biography of Ben Franklin. As the former head of CNN, former managing editor of Time, what did you find most interesting about Ben Franklin's philosophy of being the owner of a printing press, like what it meant to own a printing press?
You know, he was a great media entrepreneur. He not only owns a printing press, but he creates all this great content. He starts a newspaper. He starts Poor Richard's Almanac. And then he franchises it so that all of his friends and former apprentices and relatives across the colonies, he franchises the print shops. And then he creates the U.S. Postal Service so he can have this wonderful distribution system. And he even uses a distribution system to help advantage his content and his own franchises. So in that sense, he was like one of the modern media entrepreneurs of today. And but he believed very much in an open system. He believed in allowing as much competition as possible, as many voices as possible in the media, and he hated the notion of media conglomeration or media domination.
He also believed in publishing many different points of view. He said there'd be very little printed if publishers produced only things that offended nobody.
Oh, that's a wonderful editorial when he first takes over the Pennsylvania Gazette. It's called Apology for Printers. And he was criticized for something he printed, and as you say, and he ends by saying, and if truth and falsity each have fair play, truth will always win out over the falsities. And that's the important thing, you know, that helped this country was a belief in robust discourse, many different voices of opinion, and Franklin, who, as you said, led this slightly flawed personal life, There were more articles at the time, whenever he ran for election, that would make modern-day stories about Bill Clinton or anything else seem pale by comparison. But Franklin loved it all. He was very honest about his life, and he loved a raucous press. And he didn't mind. He never threatened to sue for libel or anything.
What do you consider the most important thing he ever published?
I think the most important thing, types of writing he did, were those in favor of religious tolerance. And, for example, he did an appeal for a new hall they wanted to build in Philadelphia. And he said, even if the Mufti of Constantinople were to send somebody here to preach Muhammad to us, we ought to give him a pulpit. And over again, he wrote things that said we have to be tolerant of all religions. And I think that it's something we forget as being the core value of America. And as we go into the 21st century, we're facing religious fanaticism around the world. But even religious fundamentalism threatens our liberties at home. I think Franklin's notion of tolerance is the thing I most want people to take from this book.
Ben Franklin went to London to live. He lived there for 11 years, starting in 1765. He went as a representative from the Pennsylvania legislature. Was he a royalist then?
He believed in the British Empire. He called the British Empire a fine, noble China vase. And he said, once it gets shattered, we'll never be able to put it back together. So he fought long and hard for the type of compromises and the type of accommodation that would allow the empire to stay together. And he very much was a believer in the king. He wanted to turn Pennsylvania from being a proprietary colony into a royal colony, but he did not want to overthrow the British Empire or to have an American Revolution until much later.
What's the meaning of a proprietary colony?
It just meant that the Penn family was sort of the owners of the colony. So instead of being governed directly by the king, it was governed by these proprietors who owned it, the Penn family.
So what changed Franklin's mind about being a royalist? What turned him into a supporter of the American Revolution?
It was pretty late, around 1774, 1775. He finally gives up all hope that he can hold things together. He's humiliated by the British ministers and by the king's ministers, the prime minister in London, as he tries to argue that they should not subject the colonies to tyranny and to taxation without representation. And so finally he sails back from London in early 1775, gets back to America, and he declares his break with Britain and becomes a patriot and a rebel.
What do you think was his greatest contribution to organizing for the Revolutionary War?
Well, he was the one who came up first with the concept of federalism, really, which is taking all the different colonies, 13 colonies, and saying that they'd each remain colonies or states, but they'd be part of a larger whole, that you'd have a federal government as well as state governments. And in as early as 1754, in the Albany Plan, it was called, because they went to Albany, New York, to discuss it, he came up with a plan for uniting the colonies. And then even in 1776, as they're writing the Declaration of Independence, he comes up with the first Articles of Confederation, where you share power between the states and the federal government.
He went to France to get aid for the Revolutionary War, financial aid. What made him so good at that task?
He was very seductive. He goes to France, and even though he's a city person, he's lived in Philadelphia and in London his whole life, he knows that the French romanticize the frontier. So he rides into the streets of Paris wearing a fur cap and a leather frock and pretending to be the sage and philosopher from the frontier and from the backwoods and stuff. And he never wears the powdered wigs, and he has all these portraits of himself painted. He really understood the value of celebrity. He also understood the nobility and idealism of the American cause. He had helped Thomas Jefferson write the Declaration of Independence, and he had the Declaration reprinted in France, where he knew it would appeal to the sentiments of the people. In fact, he made a remarkable edit to the Declaration of Independence, because when Jefferson wrote it, Jefferson had written, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable." And Franklin changed that to, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." He said, "It's an assertion of reason, not of religion. of where we get our rights as a people. And that fit very much in with what Voltaire and Rousseau and the French philosophes were doing. And so he reprints all of these letters and the Declaration of Independence so he can appeal to the hearts and the minds of the French people.
Yeah, when Franklin changed the word sacred for self-evident, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. What did self-evident literally mean to him?
You know, he was a friend and a student of David Hume, who may have been the greatest of the British philosophers of the time. And there were certain truths that Hume said were not even based on evidence, which, like Philadelphia being larger or smaller than London, that's just based on evidence. But certain truths are there just by virtue of reason, almost by virtue of definition, like all bachelors are unmarried or all triangles have 180 degrees or something. And he said those are just intuitive, natural truths that you just have to look into the nature of the world to know that they're true. And that's what he meant about all people being created equal in terms of their political rights.
Did he get any argument from Jefferson about that change, do you know?
No, although there was a wonderful story, because Jefferson was very kind to Franklin. He just adored Franklin. And he wrote him these nice letters thanking him for the edits and saying, you know, he valued all the wisdom. So then they bring the document to Congress itself, and they're debating it on the floor of Congress. And, you know, Franklin had made these few small word changes, which Jefferson liked. Well, Congress started tearing the document apart, throwing out whole paragraphs, rewriting parts of it. And Jefferson got more and more depressed. And so Benjamin Franklin told him the tale of the first time that he had had a customer, and he wanted a sign that said, you know, John Smith makes and sells hats for ready cash on Market Street. And then all of his friends edited the sign. And at first they took out makes and sells. Well, you don't need that. You can just say he sells hats, and then you don't need to say ready cash. And by the end of it, everybody had taken out different parts of it, and it just said John Smith with a little hat next to it, is all the sign said. And Franklin said, that's why I always make it a habit never to be involved in writing documents that are going to be debated by a public body, because they're going to tear it apart. And Jefferson found it so amusing that he calmed down and didn't get upset at the way they were tearing apart his Declaration of Independence.
Walter Isaacson is the author of the new book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Benjamin Franklin, the abolitionist. We continue our conversation with Walter Isaacson. Also, journalist Ted Conover describes his visit to the prison on Guantanamo Bay, where hundreds of suspected terrorists are being held. Conover spent a year as a prison guard in Sing Sing and wrote about it in his book, New Jack.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Walter Isaacson. He's written a new biography of Benjamin Franklin. He's also the author of a biography of Henry Kissinger. Isaacson is the former managing editor of Time magazine, former chair of CNN, and is now the president of the public policy think tank, the Aspen Institute. It's always interesting to see what each of the founding fathers believed about slavery and whether they owned slaves or not. What were Franklin's thoughts about slavery before the Revolution?
You know, when you deal with any of the founders, you have to wrestle with the institution of slavery. And Franklin himself wrestled with that institution. He owned a couple of slaves, off and on, household slaves throughout his life, and then he freed them. He printed some of the first anti-slavery tracts as a young newspaper man, but he also carried ads in his newspaper for the buying and selling of slaves. As his life went on, he became more and more anti-slavery, first against the slave trade and then for the freeing of all slaves. And it was the one sort of blot on a record spent fighting tyranny over all forms of oppression to man. And so at the end of his life, he takes on the job as the president of this abolition society, the Society for the Abolition of Slavery, and dedicates the last few years in his life to fighting slavery and to try to remove that blot from his record.
Early in his life, when he was skeptical of slavery, he wasn't an abolitionist at this point, but he thought it wasn't necessarily a good thing. He opposed it because he thought it wasn't healthy for the white owners, you know, that it would make the children lazy and shun work. What were his reasons when he became an abolitionist for opposing slavery?
You're right. He first starts off by saying economically it makes no sense. Then he says it makes no sense even for the owners because it makes us less industrious. And then finally he says it is just morally abhorrent to tyrannize another individual. And he was a believer in the end of slavery because of the very pure reason that all people are created equal and nobody should be denied rights by race, religion, or color. And that was a petition that he submitted to Congress near the end of his life. That's what he fought for. And then some Southern congressman from Georgia got up and made a speech on the floor of the House ridiculing him for saying that. And Franklin's last great parody that he writes, I mean, as a 16-year-old, he had written under the pen name of Silence Dugood. Now in his 80s, on his deathbed, he writes another pseudonymous piece for the newspaper in which he parodies this congressman by pretending to have discovered the speech 100 years ago delivered by somebody in Africa who was defending the enslavement of white Christians and why it made sense to enslave white Christians. And it's an exact parody of the Southern congressman's speech. And there's Franklin on his deathbed trying to attack the institution of slavery with his pen.
Did Franklin have arguments with other founding fathers about slavery?
No, he was not an argumentative sort, and he probably should have had arguments on slavery, but during the Constitutional Convention, after a while, it became unspoken. People knew if they got into an argument about slavery, they would never end up with a constitution for a new country. They would split apart. And Franklin thought of raising the issue of slavery and forcing a debate and an argument on slavery, but instead he waits until after they finish the Constitution, and then he introduces it at the first Congress.
We haven't talked about Ben Franklin's scientific contributions. Why don't you just list some of the inventions and scientific contributions that he's responsible for?
He was the most important scientist of his time for one reason, which is he was the one who first figured out the nature of the flow of electricity. That electricity was a flow. He invented the terms positive and negative, or plus and minus, the term battery and condenser. And then he extended that to understand that lightning was a form of electrical discharge and that you could sap the charges from a cloud through a lightning rod. And up until then, lightning had been one of the most devastating scourges facing the earth. I mean, they used to ring church bells to try to ward off lightning, and in one year, 300 bell ringers got killed because of it. Franklin finally said, you know, we ought to try some different way of doing this, and he comes up with his lightning rod experiments. So that's the most important thing he does, is the lightning rod and discovering the nature of lightning. Also, there's hundreds of useful devices. He, like in his politics, he was very practical and pragmatic in his science. He invents the bifocals. He invents the Franklin stove, so you have clean-burning stoves. He invents fins so that you can swim with, and odometers, and many other things like that that make life a little bit easier.
What did the other founding fathers think of Ben Franklin? You know, because here he is, among other things, doing all this, like, tinkering and inventing and science, in addition to negotiating treaties and editing the Declaration of Independence. I mean, he has all these different lives.
Well, you know, I guess the most interesting relationship is the one with John Adams. And, you know, people say, well, Adams hated him and stuff. No, it's far more complicated. There was a grudging admiration and love-hate, especially on Adams's part, towards Franklin. And they begin their relationship once when they were off in 1775 or so, 1776 maybe, negotiating with Lord Howe on Staten Island to see Lord Howe had wanted the Americans to surrender during the Revolution. And so Franklin and Adams are sent to Staten Island to negotiate with them. Franklin's had this great theory about the contagious nature of colds, that you didn't catch cold by getting cold. You caught colds because germs, which he turned out to be right about. So they have to share a room on the way to Staten Island, and Franklin keeps opening the window in the middle of winter, and Adams keeps wanting it shut, and they have this big argument about it. And finally, Adams concedes and lets Franklin explain his entire theory of the contagious nature of colds. And for years afterwards, both in Paris and in Philadelphia and other places, they were sort of rivals with each other, but friendly rivals who respected each other's patriotism. But Adams was very prudish and puritanical, and he thought that Franklin was, sort of repelled or appalled by Franklin's lascivious ways with the women of Paris. So that was the most amusing relationship.
So Franklin had lascivious ways with the women of Paris?
I think he would love to have had lascivious ways. I think by that point he was pushing 80, and so he had a lot of girlfriends in Paris, and he once played chess, and while Madame Briand, one of his girlfriends, soaked in the bathtub. But I, you know, maybe I'm a little too innocent or a little too naive. I think these were flirtations more of the mind and of the soul and of the heart than of the body.
Are you ever amused or even annoyed by the ways in which certain politicians and commentators invoke the names of the founding fathers for whatever political agenda they're pushing at the moment?
I am, which is why I wanted to write about one of the founders. I think that it's important to understand the founders in all of their complexity, not to look upon them as two-dimensional, not to look at them as pure paragons of virtue, but of really honest flesh and blood people who did some extraordinary things and actually were able to cobble together a nation that survived so well for three centuries. But you don't like the founding fathers to be invoked for every new idea that comes down the pike.
Walter Isaacson, he's the author of the new book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. Coming up, after spending a year as a prison guard at Sing Sing, journalist Ted Conover visits the prison for suspected terrorists in Guantanamo Bay. This is Fresh Air. After September 11th, Guantanamo Bay became the site of a prison for suspected terrorists who are being held for interrogation. There are currently about 700 detainees from 42 countries. Last month, the human rights group Amnesty International released its annual report, which described Guantanamo as a human rights scandal and called on the U.S. government to release or charge those held there. It's difficult to get access to Guantanamo and virtually impossible to talk with the detainees. Journalist Ted Conover visited Guantanamo and wrote about it in an article published last Sunday in the New York Times Magazine. He says that he wanted to see what kind of community had grown there and what it might say about America's attitude toward these prisoners of war. Conover is very familiar with American prisons. He spent a year as a guard at the maximum security prison Sing Sing and wrote about the experience in his book New Jack. I asked him to describe the cells in the Guantanamo prison, Camp Delta.
They have been fashioned out of those shipping containers that you see on the backs of trucks and on the big container ships, those elongated metal boxes. Apparently they cut out the sides, they replaced them with mesh, they put doors in, a window to the outside, they put a roof overhead, a sort of squatting toilet that they say is more customary on the other side of the world, and a bunk bed. So you end up with quite a small cell, 6 feet 8 inches wide and by 8 feet wide. So that is smaller than any cell, for example, in Sing Sing prison that I where I worked. And the way that the detainees are held there is quite severe. It's stricter than even a prisoner in the United States, say, who'd killed another prisoner and was being punished. They still get let out every day for exercise. That's required by law, I think, everywhere. But because Guantanamo is not U.S. territory, and these detainees have not been designated POWs, we don't have to treat them any particular way, I guess. And so when I was there, they were let out twice a week for 15 minutes each in a big cage by themselves with a soccer ball. Since then, I think the minimum has come up to 3 exercise periods of 20 minutes. But that's a long time to be in a very small cage.
You say that Camp Delta seems to be modeled on the Supermax prison of the United States, the Supermax approach to solitary confinement. What's right. The comparison?
Well, you know, until 25 years ago, there weren't whole prisons devoted to solitary confinement. There might be a part of a prison that had just a few cells for inmates who'd misbehaved, you know, who couldn't obey the rules, who hurt the guards or hurt other prisoners. But then, even there, you know, they're usually let out to exercise in a group. In the last 25 years, basically starting with the prison in Marion, Illinois, there's been this model of an entire prison of people who don't come out. Often they have their own exercise cage attached to their cell, and they're let into that for a few minutes every day. Their meals are delivered to them, and that's it. There's almost 1,000 cells now at Guantanamo. 700 are filled. But these cells seem to be based on that model of a prison. And it's a very restrictive model. I was told it's restrictive because these are extremely dangerous people.
You say that the military is bending over backwards to respect the Muslim religious practices of the people at Camp Delta. What is the military doing?
They have set up a public address system that you can hear throughout the camp, over which they broadcast a call to prayer 5 times a day. They provide every detainee with a Quran, a prayer book, oil, a kufi, the skull cap, a prayer mat, beads. When Ramadan comes around, they change the menu. They do work hard to accommodate religious practice to a degree. I mean, the thing you notice is that Muslims always pray together, you know, feet touching and next to each other. And so that's impossible given this particular setup.
Is the military being so careful about helping the prisoners observe Islamic customs because they made a mistake early on? Do they feel like they missed the boat early on in terms of religious practices?
I don't know. You know, I've thought a lot about this. They also tout the health care, which they told me several times is better than the prisoners have received in their entire lives. And they told me that on average they'd each gain 13 pounds. So they are very interested in letting the world know that the religious practice and the health care are really good. But I think the reason is that we have not designated them POW, so we are not offering them a whole range of things that the Geneva Convention, the Third Geneva Convention, provides for prisoners of war.
Since this, the prison camps in Guantanamo are regulated neither by the Geneva Conventions nor American prison regulations, are there any regulations surrounding these prisons?
Well, we were assured several times by General Miller, who runs the joint task force that runs this operation, that we were doing nothing down there that Americans wouldn't be proud of. But he won't get more specific than that. So that's not a lot to go on. And I'm afraid that some of the first signs that we've had for seeing how it's going haven't been encouraging. I was told by Captain Albert Shimkus, who runs the medical care at Camp Delta, that no detainee had ever been forcibly injected. He told me about vaccinations, and he said eventually everyone was persuaded that a vaccination was in their best interest. They didn't have to do anything forcible, and they never had with injections. Well, then a couple weeks ago, some New York Times reporters finally tracked down some of the detainees that had been released. They were found in Afghanistan. One of them had been one of the 28 suicide attempts so far by somewhere around 20 individuals that they've registered at Camp Delta. He said that after his second or third one, they gave him a shot that left him unable to control his head or jaw muscles for many days and unable to feed himself. Now, maybe he's lying. Maybe he wants to make the American military look bad because he doesn't like us to begin with. But it was quite a specific kind of charge and a specific kind of complaint, and, you know, it gives you pause.
Did he say that he was given the shot against his will?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your article in the New York Times, you said that although the Geneva Conventions don't apply to these prisoners, and these prisoners are not being seen as prisoners of war by the United States, the Geneva Conventions were cited to you in explaining why the press can't have access to the prisoners.
Exactly. It's a little funny. I couldn't understand a good reason why I couldn't just see a prisoner or say hello or ask a few questions. And they cited the Geneva Conventions article, which says the detaining power shall not subject prisoners to insult or ridicule. That was the reason I couldn't see them, which struck me as a little bit odd.
There's a special mental health unit that was recently opened in Guantanamo. It was opened just shortly before you arrived there. Why was it opened, and what is it doing?
Well, you know, last year there were 10 suicide attempts among the detainees. And then in just the first 3 months of this year, there were 14 more, bringing the total to 24. It's now up to 28. And, you know, the military said this wasn't a response to the spate of suicide attempts in the first 3 months of the year. But it just seems a little bit unlikely. The rate of suicides was picking up at this incredible pace, and since they opened the mental health center, it has slowed way down. There have been just a handful. So they're trying hard to keep this problem from growing. The detainees they've caught up with in Afghanistan said, well, the problem was how small the cells were and that we didn't know how long we'd be there. And this struck a chord from my time at Sing Sing. I think you can imagine that a prisoner places a great deal of importance on the length of a sentence or the amount of months or years until a parole hearing, or if they commit an infraction, how many weeks are they going to be in solitary confinement? You know, as I wrote, knowing there's a light at the end of the tunnel makes being in the tunnel more bearable. And by not giving these prisoners any information about how long they're there for or under what circumstances they might be released, I think we've created a quite a large amount of anxiety among them, which leads to attempts at suicide. Now, am I a sympathizer? Am I a, you know, do I think they don't deserve the worst we can give them? I believe the military that these are bad people. We need to deal with them. But as an American, I like to think we will deal with them in a humane way. And I don't think slowly driving 700 people crazy is something I want my government to be doing.
My guest is journalist Ted Conover. We'll talk more about Guantanamo after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Conover, and he wrote a recent article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about the prison camps in Guantanamo in which suspected terrorists and jihadists are being held. He's also the author of a book that was published in 2000 about his year as a prison guard at Sing Sing, a maximum security prison north of New York City. Well, you were a guard in the year that you worked at Sing Sing, and one of the things that you did in Guantanamo is spend some time in the soldiers' camp, the soldiers who are guards at the prison camp for the terrorists. What are their living conditions like?
Well, they're better than the prisoners, but not by a lot. They live right next door on the same sort of barren piece of coastline that the camp is situated on. Most of them are reservists from the mainland. They were sent there for 6 months in most cases, but when I arrived, many had just found out they'd been extended for another 6 months. So they don't know how long they're going to be there either. They come from military police companies, either National Guard or regular military reserve. At least half of them work law enforcement in their other lives, with a lot of those working corrections. So a lot of them know about working in prisons and dealing with difficult people. But several of them told me that this is a particularly hard job because, you know, they start with a feeling that everybody in there hates my guts and would like me dead, which is not the typical situation if you work in a prison. You know, you can usually arrive at a point of some joking back and forth with certain prisoners who aren't too difficult. And you get to know them. You call each other by name, I think, in most prisons after a while. That doesn't describe Guantanamo. There's not a lot of sort of on-the-job you know, casualness. It's extremely serious, as I suppose it needs to be, given the way it's being run. But the language barrier keeps people from really speaking to each other. If there's a disagreement, the guards have to call a translator to come help out. There are women guards as well as men, just like in the States. And one of them told me, no, things are not always calm in there. She said, I've had everything thrown on me that a man could throw, which means body fluids. And, you know, that's typical of an American maximum security prison, too. But at least in American maximum security prison, the guards, you know, they work an eight-hour shift. They go home to their families. They have another life. And people in the military work really long hours. They wouldn't tell me exactly how many a week, but I got the feeling 60, 70, 80 hours on the job was not unusual. And I think it takes a toll. I think this is a very hard posting.
You mentioned that in American prisons, after a while, the guards and the prisoners, or at least some of them, call each other by name, that there's some sense of communication. Some of the guards in Guantanamo told you that they actually covered their own names on their uniforms. Were they afraid to have the prisoners see their names?
I think so. You know, when I worked at Sing Sing, we only let them know our last names. But at Guantanamo, they don't even want them to know that, because I think, let's say you have a distinctive last name and you anger a person who has some political clout in a country that doesn't like us, I think the soldiers are, you know, perhaps reasonably concerned that that person could bear a grudge and remember you and come and get you someday. Anyway, that's why they cover them, is out of that kind of fear, that kind of concern. When they leave the camp at night, they tear these pieces of tape off of their names sewn onto their uniforms and put them under the bills of their cap.
Did the soldiers consider this a difficult posting, or do any of them consider this a good assignment?
There is a sense of duty to one's country and of performing a service that a lot of these soldiers have that, say, a typical corrections officer would not have. You know, you don't have much of a sense of mission working in an American prison after a while. It's kind of discouraging. But the military, you know, they do a lot to try to boost morale and keep people feeling that this is part of an effort for our country, that this is an act of patriotism and loyalty. And there's a when soldiers pass each other at a checkpoint there, one will salute and say, "Honor bound," and the other replies, "To defend freedom." This is an esprit de corps kind of slogan to keep them mindful of the fact they're doing this for their country. But, you know, it's said so fast almost, you can't even tell what people are saying. I kept thinking it was a secret password of some sort. And it's a little peculiar to see this slogan on the gate of a prison camp, or at least it was to me. And I asked my first lieutenant escort if it wasn't odd to see a slogan about freedom on the gate of a prison camp. And he said, "Doesn't seem strange to me. Does it look strange to you?"
Well, I guess from his point of view, I mean, it's not the freedom of the prisoners being protected, it's the freedom of
precisely.
The Americans. Yeah.
And I was told more than once, freedom ain't free, right? We pay a price to keep our country free, and that's the way they look at it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Ted Conover's article, In the Land of Guantanamo, was published in last Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you enjoy the holiday weekend.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the Internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Elegant Gathering of White Snows, a novel about eight women whose impromptu walking quest touches a nation, by Chris Radish. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Right Stuff, we talk with three pioneers of the U.S. space program, Chuck Yeager, Chris Kraft, and Alan Shepard. Join us for the next Fresh Air.